Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and I'm here to talk about the first game of the season, the horrific loss to the Buffalo Bills, and we're going to talk about the defense specifically tonight. Going to be a short show, I think. I'm doing the show solo, and somebody else had travel plans that didn't quite work out for them. I understand that. But Ravens obviously dropped a very key game here in the AFC playoff picture in truly awful fashion. Going to be a difficult show to get through without kind of lashing out at that, I'm sure. I think if you're going to maybe try and put this in perspective, think about how great we felt after the 2003 win against the Seahawks. That win was a Ravens classic. It had everything. It had a big fourth quarter blown lead for the Seahawks with about 8 minutes to go, that began with the block punt by Ed Reed being returned, and the Ravens turning it on from there. The Hasselbeck, who was the quarterback for Seattle that day, had 5 touchdown passes, no interceptions, I think 426 yards, might have been 426 offensive yards, but it was about 426 passing yards, might have been correct too. Every time he threw the ball, went down the field, somebody catch it, they'd run into the end zone, and basically the Ravens were unable to stop that for the bulk of the day. He had his near-perfect day of 5 touchdown passes, no interceptions, ruined, very much like Lamar did in this game. Now, Lamar's was, one might say, on a smaller scale, 2 touchdown passes, no interceptions, ran for a touchdown, 144.4 passer rating. Generally, things were almost perfect for Lamar on this day. And that wasn't the problem, was not in large part the Ravens' offense and their per play productivity. They did have some problems keeping the offense on the field at certainly at key times, but it wasn't per play productivity from the offense that ruined it. It was the fact that defense got extraordinarily gassed in that fourth quarter, and that created all kinds of problems. And I know the tendency, by the way, is to look for blame all the way around. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. I'm going to save that topic. We'll talk about that. But let's get back to the 2003 game against the Seahawks, because in addition to that near-perfect day that was ruined for Hasselbeck, there was a crazy tipped ball. You'll remember it probably on 4th and 28. A lot of people think Marcus Robinson caught that ball. Marcus Robinson was actually the person who tipped that ball to the great Frank Sanders, the Ravens' other free agent acquisition that year, for a 44-yard play to convert 4th and 28. All right. That was the biggest single play of that game, in a game that has probably 15 plays I can name right off the top of my head in terms of being so outliery, special, different, they're remarkable. Marcus Robinson did have 4 touchdown catches that day. He had the big catch in overtime on third and 15, maybe, to set up the Ravens field goal. That won the game from Matt Stover, and they ended up winning the game 44-41, not dissimilar to the 41-40, score in this game. The tipped ball, we can kind of map to the tipped ball caught in the end zone by Keon Coleman, a ball that had just no business, getting into the hands of the receiver there, but it got tipped by an underneath man, very similar. He happened to have 2 guys in the same part of the field to take advantage of that, which is not always happens. We did see on one play that the Ravens had both Zay Flowers and Mark Andrews in the same spot on the field, and Zay was actually able to come up with a football for the Ravens at one point in this game. But thinking back to 2003 and taking it from the Seahawks' perspective, that was a very difficult thing to swallow. There was a timekeeping controversy in that game, a little bit different between the two, but a timekeeping controversy nonetheless, and was a great game without a little bit of clock management snafu going one way or the other. In that case, the Seahawks, the referees let them down by not restarting the clock properly after a Ravens penalty. And so they tried to get it done, tried to get it adjusted after the fact. None of that worked. And Holmgren, who was the coach of the Seahawks at the time, took the high road, frankly, after the game in terms of not blaming the officials for that. He probably would have gotten fined, but it would have been also a look that would have been not great. The Ravens, they're clearly upset that the half got put back to a second on the clock. I don't think that's reviewable. I don't think it's something where the booth can call down and say, hey, you need to put a second back on the clock because he was out of bounds. I don't know whether they're able to ask somebody upstairs. I don't know if that's the standard rule. They declared it, I think, as being after an on-field discussion. They said it's anyway, whatever the reason, they put a second back of the clock. It did look like a second should be on the clock, at least in the Ravens game. So not an unreasonable result, obviously not the position the Ravens wanted to put themselves in at that point, but probably not an unreasonable position. And then also the last thing that's this similar between these two games, the 2003 Seahawks loss to the Ravens had a huge fumble by Max Strong, where he was a fullback for Seattle, who just had the ball pried free from him by Ray Lewis at the most important time. Adalis Thomas had just had a back-breaking 15-yard personal foul assessed, and Ray Lewis tapped him on the helmet, went back and lined up, and then stripped the ball from Max Strong on the very next play, and the Ravens were able to get their play that got them within 3 points, got their touchdown that got them within 3 points on the drive that immediately followed. So, the reason I bring this up and say it's not like this is a game the NFL has never seen before, or even the Ravens have never seen before. It's a very bad loss. They've been on the other side of a great win of this type. Unfortunately, this game had tremendous AFC playoff implications to it. So it's the kind of loss that is very difficult to get over. We went to the game. I can tell you the walk back to the car was not an easy one in a lot of ways. You got every Buffalo fan wants to pick on you as you're going and try and yell, oh, we'll see you in January, maybe, you know, kind of thing. You take a lot of crap going to an opposing stadium, but it's always part of the deal that you do that. We really, really enjoy our time tailgating with some Bills fans, but some of the particularly the guys who are selling parking on their lawn in the neighborhood, they're out there trying to police their area after the game and make sure, you know, maybe people don't empty their trash from their car on their lawn and other things that, you know, can go wrong with allowing people to park on your lawn for money. They're out there trying to do that, but they're also trying to, give you trouble if you're an opposing fan, that's for sure. All right. As usual, you know, in any close game or any big comeback game, there are going to be a segment of the fan base that needs someone to blame. So we're getting back to this topic now. We've been through a season for the Orioles where Mike Elias is the guy to blame for the Orioles because, hey, he didn't get us the pitching that we needed to win the AL East this year. Well, guess what? There's probably no amount of pitching that Elias could reasonably have picked up that could have dealt with the amount of injuries that the Orioles have had, in terms of their offense and in terms of the rest of their pitching staff. So I don't think that would have helped, honestly. You want to pick on some bad, you know, acquisitions. Well, you know, O'Neill was not a great one, and that's really showing through. But I think that it's natural to want to blame Elias. Part of the other reason is that people don't really respect Mancelino, and they've already had Hyde fired. So Hyde is gone, and Hyde was the first guy that they wanted to blame for what was going on, along with Elias. But now the only adult left in the room is Elias. Mancelino is not a sure thing, let's put it that way, to be the Orioles manager next year. It likely will be somebody they go outside the building to get. And they'll want to get a real strong manager who can make good use of a talented young team, develop them and make them into more as a unit than they are as individuals here. This would be a great team to be managed by Earl Weaver. Not that there's ever a bad team to be managed by Earl Weaver, but this would be a very good one. And obviously for the Ravens, they want to blame John Harbaugh. Now it's interesting because no matter what goes wrong, Eric DaCosta had his time of being a guy that everybody wanted to fire, and that seems to have passed. The drafts have been good. It's the people who hate Eric DaCosta are lost in the woodwork somewhere, biding their time, no doubt, before they speak up and talk about how DaCosta has ruined the Ravens. But Harbaugh has been around for a long time. He's put together an extremely successful organization, and so he's the guy that everybody wants to blame. Now this was a game where I think there are reasons to look at what Harbaugh did and point to it and say this was suboptimal in terms of what occurred here. I think there are some legitimate reasons why it didn't happen, but this is a game where there were clock management issues. There was a big fourth down decision that the Ravens had, and they didn't. Neither ended up the way that the Ravens would like it. Now, let me start with what is the fundamental issue, or a fundamental issue. Part of the foundation, yes. Fundamental. That's what fundamentalism means, right? Well, anyway, the Bills perfectly controlled the clock in this game. Now, what do I mean by that? They ended each half with a half-ending field goal attempt. In the first half, they tacked on 3 points should they not have had a chance to get 3 points. And in the second half, they had the game-winning field goal as time expired. Both finished the clock of each half, which is unbelievably frustrating. And what it meant is the Bills had one extra possession. So in the first half, they had the first and last possession. In the second half, they made sure they had an even number of possessions by having the last possession. Most times, the best you can do is have effectively the last possession of each half, but to have a scoring possession and at the end of each half and a extra possession in the game is really a big deal. And the Bills did a great job, frankly, managing that, getting down the field under what were adverse circumstances the first time and very optimal circumstances the second time to finish the game. Gassed Ravens defense. And we're going to talk about that more as we go here. But let's talk about two critical junctures where I think it is reasonable to look at what Harbaugh did and what Monken did to a certain degree, what Orr did perhaps to another degree, but we'll look at this. At the end of the half, I look back to the Ravens' previous drive, and the overarching comment is that the Ravens did not get the last first down they needed to close out the half. That's the problem. The players on the field failed to get that done. But if you look at it, they could have been given some additional advantages. One of them would have been with 2:03 left, they snapped the ball. Buffalo still had 3 timeouts left, but it didn't seem like there was a reason to give them kind of one extra timeout at the 2-minute warning when the Ravens had all the time in the world they needed to score with 2 minutes left. And in fact, Lamar's had a fantastic record career-wise of scoring in the last 2 minutes of the half. So that it did not seem like they needed that play. And then what did they pull out? They pulled out a run play where they got 5 yards. Now, did that really fail them? Well, no, because on 2nd and 5, I think it was 2nd and 5, they got a 15-yard play. So they got another first down. And then you really have to look at this and say, well, is it fair that the Ravens should be put down for taking that opportunity to get 5 yards when it was actually on 3rd and 5, they got the 15-yard pass to Zay Flowers to convert. I mean, in a way, that's perfect. You got 3 plays off. You forced Buffalo to call one of their first timeout after the 3rd and 5. And it did not seem like that was a terrible result for the Ravens there. So anyway, they did not know at 2:03 exactly how the remaining plays would play out. Getting one more is almost like calling a timeout yourself, and it's kind of a premature call of a timeout. I don't think the actual play result went against the Ravens, and that's what Harbaugh is talking about in his interviews either today or after the game. You know, they took an opportunity to get a 5-yard play when they didn't think the Bills were really ready to play defense. And if that's, you know, as far as it goes, then I think there's some wisdom in saying that basically they didn't know exactly how it was going to play out, but they did give, what it did is give Buffalo a chance to not use some timeouts there. And as it turned out, they might've had to use one timeout after the fact and gotten 30 seconds left to run their offense. But the Ravens also weren't sure that they were going to get a first down there, and they didn't know how the plays would run out. It's just they did have enough time. So if you're looking for a reason to blame Harbaugh, I think that's one of the good ones, is that probably he should have spoken up on the headset loop and said, "Hey, Monk, I know you're going to call another play here, but why don't you let this run down to the 2-minute warning?" And it would have been a quick overriding of what would have happened. It's probably a rare case where it's fair to blame Harbaugh, although I think Monken also needs to take responsibility for the clock management there and make that decision. Obviously, between the two of them, they decided that it was a good idea to run the football for 5 yards with 2:03 to go. The decisions after that were largely made directly by Buffalo calling timeout on 3 consecutive plays, beginning on the 3rd and 5 at 1:53. That just kind of forced the play. And then a timeout at 1:38 after a run for minus, a disastrous play by Hill that went for minus 9 yards. Actually went for minus 15 yards, didn't it? Because he went back, just ran for minus 6. He fumbled. He recovered it at the 29. Then he ran for another minus 3. So he actually had minus 15 on the play. And then, you know, they threw a 1 yard pass and then Jackson ran for no gain. At least they kept the ball on the ground there, but they only had one play of true runoff there, still had to kick the ball with 35 seconds to go. Now that probably should have been enough. They kicked the field goal with 35 seconds left. There's actually 31 seconds left when they kicked off. That probably should have been enough. All right. But the Bills, you know, have been burnt in the last 13 seconds by Mahomes. Weren't sitting down at that point. And they got a 26-yard play. They ran up and spiked it quickly. And they still had 7 seconds left after the spike. And they got the ball to the outside. Now, what happened on that next play, on the last play with 7 seconds to go, is a little bit frustrating from multiple directions. But the Ravens decided to rush 0 on that play. So they rushed none. They dropped everybody to coverage. And they had an odd formation where they had 2 inside linebackers on the field. So it was Roquan and Trenton Simpson. They had 2 outside linebackers on the field. That's Kyle Van Noy and Adafi Owe. And they were both lined up at the sideline and at the sticks. So 10 yards down the field, which would have brought that field goal kind of to the maximum distance I think they could ask Matt Prater to kick from, which had been about 53 to 54 yards at that time. So obviously Prater, it might have been 55 yards, even if they got exactly 10 yards, it looks like. So Prater's a guy they signed off the street. He had a big leg and kicked, a 64-yard field goal early in his career. I may have him confused with somebody. That was Matt Elam, wasn't it, for Denver? So anyway, Prater's a longtime kicker in this league. He's certainly had good success kicking from over 50 yards in his career, but not a guy who I think at this point at age 41 is still ready to kick some long field goals. So anyway, the real reason that they had the sticks guarded at that distance by the outside linebackers didn't have anything to do with a pass. It had to do with a run by Allen. So they were trying to police the field. So if Allen was going to run, he's going to have to run to the middle of the field, and then they would otherwise have 9-on-5 to cover, or even 7-on-5, if you want to think about that, with 2 spies for Allen in the middle of the field. You don't really need a spy for Allen in the middle of the field if you're going to run your normal coverage, because he can't leave down the middle of the field or he'll be tackled and the half will be over. So he's got to throw the ball in that situation. I still didn't like the giving him the opportunity to throw with no pressure at all. I think even rushing 2 or 3 would have been a better choice. We saw a few years ago that exact move failed in the Carolina game. That was in 2018 at Carolina. Tried the exact same thing. I think it was Olsen who caught a ball for a number of yards. It was a tight end anyway, who caught a ball for a number of yards, and that set up a field goal right between the half. And what ended up being a 15-point loss. You know, one of those losses that kind of sticks with you because it's to a bad team. The decision to rush 0, I didn't really like. So there are some things with clock management, certainly. I think that the Ravens probably thought they had a good opportunity, but they also thought that they had a chance to really catch the Bills off guard with a positive play there that really might have moved the ball. So they had their reasons for what they did at the end of the half. I still don't really love it in either case. I think if you have a criticism on that, it's a fair criticism. Here's the point I would make about it. Its relative value in the grand scheme of things is fairly low, okay? And there, I mean, that tells you there's not that many decisions that a head coach would make during the game, in terms of game management, that are likely to be wrong by a lot. And the ones that there are more likely to come on like fourth down decisions where you give away 2 or 3% of a victory. This was nowhere near that. I could state that absolutely. A decision to run a play with 2:03 to go did not have anywhere near a 2 or 3% change in the impact of winning at the time. And Mike Tomlin regularly makes such decisions, you know, on cowardly punts. I think that it was a, it wasn't ideal, but also wasn't a high magnitude thing. Now, I feel a little bit different about the 4th-and-3 decision at the end of the game. Now, there were extenuating circumstances, but I would say those extenuating circumstances probably should have ruled the day in this situation. And the Ravens defense was absolutely gassed at this point. I don't think it really mattered how good a punt you would get in that situation, that it wasn't going to be a long enough field. No field was going to be long enough to stop Josh Allen and the Bills, who had carved up the Ravens defense in that fourth quarter, from doing it again and moving the ball up the field with a fairly high probability. So I really wanted them to go for the 4th-and-3. And then they had an additional advantage that they had there. They had redraw value to the situation. So basically putting the Bills in field goal range by losing the ball to them has value the Ravens could have derived on a redraw. So if they could have stopped the Bills on 3 downs there, and the Bills would have been playing 3-down football, not 4-down football, then they could have had a chance to get the ball back after a successful field goal and still have time to drive. They had 3 timeouts themselves at that point. And the problem with it was that Lamar took a huge hit on the Ravens' last offensive play. And he talked about at the podium, he talked about he was cramping and he wasn't really expecting to play another play. So they probably would have had to call timeout there and a full timeout to get the commercial break in there and whatnot that would allow them to work on Lamar a little bit. If it was his legs, you know, fix that up. If not, it's, you know, smelling salts or whatever would be necessary to get it back on the field and productive. So it was a decision there that I think was probably the correct decision from a mathematical perspective. It would be more the correct decision given the Ravens' current situation at the time, meaning how gassed that defense was. And if you think back, the game that you probably immediately think back to is how they went for it on 4th-and-1 against the Chiefs in the year they beat the Chiefs, 2021, I think it was. Anyway, the year they beat the Chiefs in Baltimore, they beat them 36-35, and Lamar ran up the clock with a 4th-down conversion. I think it would have made sense to do it here. Harbaugh seemed to insinuate from his presser today that the football strategy guys were telling him there was an increase in win probability for going for it. They probably told him more than that. They probably said, hey, there's a 2 or 3% increase in win probability for going for it. And what do you think about our guys being gassed and how that would play into it? So that was, I think that the Ravens probably cost themselves more in terms of win probability with that 4th-and-3 decision than obviously with the early decision to run a snap at 2:03. But Lamar had just limped off the field, and he has to be a big part of any such decision. It's not just what your defense is, and that the defense was not, they just were not prepared to stop Josh Allen at the end of that football game. They're way too tired. They had nothing left in the tank as pass rushers. And it really showed on that last drive. The secondary got continually torched by extended plays. They even had time to run some short little plays, you know, a 6-yard play, an 8-yard play, to get the drive started, if I recall correctly. So it wasn't like things were in the favor of the Ravens. Yeah, there's 1:26 when they got the ball. First play was for 6 yards, second play for 8 yards, then a scramble for 5 yards. They got a minute left at their own 34-yard line, and it felt like they might have had 5 minutes left in terms of the functional amount of time on the clock. Then they had a penalty, and you're like, oh, wait a minute, 2nd and 10 here. Maybe we got a shot. And then 32-yard play, 25-yard play, and the lights go out. So it wasn't obviously where they wanted to be at such a point. And the 4th-and-3 decision, I think Harbaugh is keeping a stiff upper lip today, talking about how much he trusted his defense. I think if he was asked with a little bit of sodium pentothal injected that he would say, yeah, our defense really wasn't ready to defend any a field of any length at that point in the game. And, you know, maybe they could have gotten off with a turnover. They did try some things late in the game. I've seen somebody saying that the coverage was all the same. It's not really entirely true. The Ravens ran some different coverages, particularly in some key situations. They had 2 7-man blitzes, the last of which was on the 25-yard play, the first of which came on a 51-yard pass, a little outlet pass. So a lot of the things they did to scheme things up about against Allen weren't working in the game. So that makes it difficult to try and do anything special, you know, rush numbers, even, you know, try zone blitzes of various sorts. Allen just was, he's very good reading hot in this game. If they had Richardson at quarterback, the Indianapolis kid who got himself injured in the preseason against the Ravens, it would have been a different story, but he's a little bit too good. Mahomes has been too good to scheme up a lot of blitzes against. And generally, whenever you do it, you've been doing him a favor. We're going to get into the pass rush results by number a little bit later, but it just, the things that they did to scheme up changes didn't work in general for the night. And they did do a fair amount of package variation. They just, in the fourth quarter, they stuck with mostly their primary, their guys who were actually getting it done on the day. And they were absolutely out of energy. The Ravens are outsnapped by this way in the game, 78 to 50. And I also often talk about that. And I say, it's not just how many plays you're on the field in total. It's how many plays the defense is on the field consecutively. And what you can see from the Ravens drive chart is that they averaged only 3.8 plays per offensive drive for the entire game. So they had the ball 11 times. Let me make sure. Oh, I'm sorry. That was after the first drive. So the very first drive, they had 12 plays on, and they drove down. They had that field goal. After that, they had 38 plays over 10 drives. So that's 3.8 plays per drive. You want to further subdivide that into the second half? They had the ball 7 times. And they only had 22 offensive plays. That's 3.2 plays per drive. What that meant is the Bills had lots of long chances to possess the ball in between those drives, and it never really seems like very much time if you're only getting three plays to get a breather on the bench. If you look at what was happening, particularly in goal line, but also at other times on the field when they had a chance to pan to the Ravens defense, you're going to see a lot of players with hands on their hips looking like they're completely out of gas. And when I see that, I know there's basically no chance of a defensive stop. And there've been a couple times in Ravens history where I've seen this, where I've said they need to do anything possible to not let the defense get on the field again. This was one of those games. They needed to figure out a way. And a lot of this is, you know, it seems silly, but the offense scored 40 points, but they let the defense down in the fourth quarter with what they did then. I mean, after Henry's touchdown, obviously the fumble was dramatically awful in terms of how it turned the game around and immediately put a very tired unit back on the field. They scored almost, you know, the Bills scored almost immediately after that with a pass that went down to the 1 yard line. And then they might have taken 3 plays to punch it in, but they effectively were already guaranteed a score on the first or second offensive play. So, the Ravens defense just, they weren't ready to play longer in that fourth quarter. And some of that was due to the offense, you know, either giving the ball up too quickly or perversely scoring too quickly in many other cases.
Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything. Data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Ravens had scoring drives. They had touchdown scoring drives in this game of 6 plays, 4 plays, 4 plays, 3 plays, and 4 plays. Seems like a good thing, but it's almost like a 3-and-out from the defense's perspective in terms of tiring. So they scored 5 touchdowns, and their explosiveness, what Henry did, what Zay Flowers did in this game in terms of getting open down the field, probably actually had a negative impact on the defense in terms of their ability to keep their wind. They depend on a lot of their first line guys, as deep as this team is, particularly on the defensive line. They don't really want to end up with Broderick Washington and maybe even Aeneas Peebles on the field in key situations. They're looking to keep their primary guys, Matabike and Jones, on for as many snaps as possible. Those guys almost always play together. And when they have to play the backups otherwise, including Jenkins too, by the way, they're just getting a lower quality of player. And so they know it. They went to the dime, and they had a lot of trouble with the dime because Alexander had a truly awful game. And that's at the basis of all their problems with the dime is that the other thing is that the pass rush didn't do a very good job of containing Josh Allen. I'm going to get to that in a minute, but the coverage was awful as a group. I'll start with this, and I'm going to give specific pass rush numbers in the second part of the show. But Josh Allen should have thrown for about 268.5 yards given his opportunity set. You guys remember this from last year, probably good, the regular listeners I'm sure do, but I'm going to explain it again. I divide each pass play into one of three categories. It's either ATS for ample time and space. Those plays, I project a 8.5 average yards per play expectation onto those. If the ball is out quickly, it means the ball was out before there was an opportunity for pressure to develop, but I can't say for certain that pressure would not have developed before 3 seconds. Those ball out quick plays, which involves a lot of quickly designed plays to get the ball outside on slants and things, are almost always ball out quick unless it's a very quick pressure. Those plays have an average of, or expectation of, 6 yards per play. And then there's the pressure plays. And that's basically any time that the cone is imperiled within 3 seconds. It has to be within 3 seconds, because if the quarterback has more time than that, it'll be an ample time and space opportunity. And he just didn't get rid of the ball in time, or he may have, not made use of the situation. Or he may, as he did in this game, make great use of the situation on an extended play. But in the case of a pressure, the expectation is at 3.5 yards per play. So put those all together for his opportunity set, and he should have thrown for about 268.5 yards. He actually threw for 389, which was 120 better than his expectation. That works out to 2.6 yards per play better than was what his expectation would be. Now, Lamar Jackson fairly often beats his opportunity set by that sort of number, but no way on average for a year would he do that, even in his MVP season. He didn't. So, or last year when he was the MVP, but didn't get it. He didn't average that for the whole year either. So, it was a bad day. Now that blame is really shared very broadly on the defense. I want to make this clear. I think that the secondary played pretty poorly and we're having a lot of trouble keeping pace with the receivers, particularly in the second half. But also the pass rush allowed Allen to escape the pocket too many times. So they pressured him a very reasonable number of times. I think it was 16 in total, but they only closed on him once, only had one sack. They had a couple other quarterback hits. One of those was very late not that it was dirty, but one was late by Owe, another was late by Van Noy, actually. So, you know, those don't really count as pressures within 3 seconds. And I believe in each of those cases, it ended up being a pretty significant play. One was down the left sideline for about 20 yards. And the other one was the tip ball for the miraculous touchdown that kept them in the game. So, the pressure they got, they didn't convert on it. And when Allen got outside the pocket because he was flushed by pressure, that pressure didn't end up being as meaningful as the Ravens would hope it to be. So, closing's the important thing. They did get enough pressure. They got a good relationship between pressure and ATS for the game, more than 1-1, 16-13. But that pressure it wasn't as useful. And then on the back end, they had a lot of problems with players not being in the right place. And, you know, it's hard to really beat on one guy more than the others because Humphrey certainly had a play he gave up at the end of the half. Roquan missed a big tackle on that 51-yard play to Cook that set him up on one of their touchdowns. There was another missed tackle on that play too, and I'm forgetting who had the first one. Might have been a Woozie, but they had multiple missed tackles on that play. And they Alexander though had a very costly DPI. He was beaten on another play down the left sideline for a conversion on 3rd and 8 or 9 for about 17 yards. That was another bad one. So he had a very poor first game. I almost have to question, was he really ready to go or not physically? He didn't seem to be there, and it definitely seemed like Allen decided that was the guy they wanted to pick on. And they went after him in a variety of ways, but it was a lot of back shoulder to Keon Coleman. A big slant to Keon Coleman was one of the big plays towards the end. That was a play right before they set them up for the game-winning field goal, was a slant to Coleman. So, they got after him in a variety of ways, and unfortunately, he was not up to the task. It was actually kind of funny that he tried to trip up Coleman on that play. It's hard to ask people for a lot of on-field IQ because I think Coleman would have known, might have known to go down. But if he'd actually gone in the end zone, it would have been better for the Ravens. They probably would not have been able to score within the amount of time remaining. But it was a case where a receiver was going to take a touchdown that he probably should have taken a knee on. So we've seen that happen before. All right. What else to say about this game? I think I've said in words what that means, so I'm not going to try and repeat what I've kind of outlined for myself here. The Ravens tackled effectively in the game, with the exception of that 51-yard play, by the way. They had some not too terribly costly missed tackles. Buchanan had a nice stretch to the left sideline where he ended up missing a tackle, but there were two players there to stop the Bills and force a field goal attempt on, I think it was a 3rd and 8. They might have gained 3 yards on a play over the left side. It wasn't all bad on defense, but it certainly wasn't mostly good. And the Ravens' big failing was that on very high leverage downs, when they had the dime in, they just couldn't get it done. And Allen really picked him apart in those situations. He picked Alexander apart specifically. And Alexander was on the field for dime plays. He wasn't on the field otherwise. He was on the play, I feel, for I think one nickel play, but he wasn't a third corner on the field ever. He was always the fourth corner with otherwise, other than that one play I'm mentioning. And so that was odd. All right. So a few things, other things that happened in this game, we'll just call them like that. The Ravens had a 2+ sack streak of 20 consecutive games that ended in this game. Now that's in the regular season, but they have also had consecutive one sack games against Buffalo, including the two playoff games, which essentially have been two different endings to it, to the streak in different ways. Obviously, this is not a good sign that they can't get after Allen. We did think that the pass rush would be one of the strengths of the Ravens this year. I'll be interested to see how it works out against other mobile quarterbacks. Flacco's coming to town next week. He should be a guy the Ravens will have more success getting on the ground, I would think. He's a guy who, if they can get the same kind of pressure in the face that Allen had, I don't think Flacco will stand up to it nearly as well. But against other mobile quarterbacks, we'll see how it works. And the league probably does have more mobile quarterbacks now than pocket passers. The natural kind of evolution is for a player age-wise to age into being more of a pocket passer and less of a mobile quarterback. But there are a lot of young quarterbacks in the league who can really, really run. And we're lucky we've got one of them and the guy who's the most elusive of them all. But there are a lot of quarterbacks who can make plays with their legs right now. All right, the Bills converted on 8 of 15 attempts on third or fourth down. That doesn't even really fully get at the severity of the problem, the gravity of the problem. They were 7 of 15 on third down, but then they got one of those back on fourth down, and then they also had a third down converted by penalty and a fourth down converted by penalty, that horrible DPI on Alexander. Mix of problems, but pretty similar in terms of they just couldn't get Buffalo off the field. It's not like they didn't do it at all, but they didn't do it effectively enough. They allowed 5 of 7 red zone entrances to be converted for touchdowns. That's terrible. And the Ravens, the league average, I'm forgetting what exactly the league average is, but the Ravens have been as low as 44% in a season not that long ago. Ravens last year had a great year where they were in the low 70s for the whole year, or right around 70%, I'll say, for the whole year. So allowing the other team to go 5 for 7 is very bad. Don't have any excuse for it. They allowed 1 for 3 themselves is all they needed in the red zone, and they still scored 5 touchdowns in the game because Derrick Henry kept running him in from long range, and Zay Flowers and Hopkins had big catches from outside that range that led to other ones. But it's a tough day in the red zone for the Ravens by their own standards. Okay, now they allowed 29 total first downs in the game. I'm trying to find in the Ravens media guide whether or not that's the record against the Ravens. I suspect it's probably there's been one or two higher in the very early days of the Ravens, like the 96 Ravens specifically, who had a lot of problems defensively, a lot of injuries that led to some high first down totals. Maybe the New England game, they gave up that kind of number in a 46-38 loss. But I think it's very close to the highest number of first downs the Ravens have ever given up. The media guide, by the way, does not seem to have that record section anymore. And if anybody can correct me on that, just DM me and tell me what page that record is, the record for opponent first downs in a single game. It's always something that used to be in the media guide, but I just don't see it this year in the 25 media guide. So hopefully it's still there. They didn't have a rash of defensive penalties. They had 4 in total, sort of 3, because one of them happened on a 2-point try, but or on a 1-point try, I should say. But the two costly DPIs, one, the first one was on Alexander. The second one was on Wiggins happened to come on 4th and 5 and 3rd and 3. So exceptionally bad times for that. They did have a neutral zone infraction by Matabike, which was a little bit costly, but it wasn't a backbreaker because it's not an automatic first down. And then while the Bills were making a point after attempt, they had a 12-man on the field penalty, which enticed the Bills to go for a 2-point try instead from the 1-yard line, which they failed. So that was nice. It happened to work out in their favor. Occasionally you get lucky on a penalty like that, but I don't think that's not considered defensive foul, and it may not even be included in the penalty total overall. I didn't check to try and prove that out, but it may not be included in the penalty total overall for the Ravens, because if there would not be yardage attached to it, even if it was walked off, Just the way there's not yardage ascribed to any result of a two-point play or a sack or whatever like that. So, I'd like to say that defensive fouls were not a problem, but having two costly DPIs like that is just that's too much of a amount of phlegm to swallow to say that that's really true. I think one of the interesting general things in terms of what's going on with the Ravens, and you know, I always talk about how it's the first game of the year, you're going to see a lot of new things from the team. Well, the inside linebacker situation is dramatically unresolved. All right. I kind of thought from the way the preseason had gone that they'd made their choice between Simpson and Buchanan. Simpson was generally playing earlier, although he did play kind of long in one of the games. But they were playing Buchanan some with the green dot to get him used to that since he's the backup Mike linebacker. At least I suspect that's the way it would play out. But in this game, Simpson and Buchanan split the playing time at the will spot, and that's what playing time there was for a second inside linebacker because the Ravens played a lot of dime in this game, as I mentioned. They wanted to have an extra coverage guy there in level two. And they replaced him on most obvious passing situations. It ended up being a lot of snaps in the game, something like 25, I think, dime snaps. They had a quarter snap. So they had, you know, a fair number of total snaps that they went with six or seven DBs. I think what bothers me about this is that the Ravens kind of haven't been able to make a call so far. And maybe they want to rotate. Maybe it's as important to them to develop Buchanan as it is to get Simpson going. But Simpson is a third-year player. I mean, they kind of either need to decide what he is, which would mean just making him a backup and special teams player, or they need to try and make him into what he is, which could be a solid inside linebacker who would generate a comp pick after next year. You know, if you want to think in positive terms, if you want to think in other terms, they could decide to re-sign him after this year if he has a big year. It would work out better for the Ravens, and you always will hear me saying this, that the rookie takes the job of a third-year player. And the Ravens seem to be positioning this to allow it to happen, but they still haven't committed to either one of them on passing downs. And I do expect the Ravens are going to continue to play the dime. They did it in this game, despite the fact they only had three safeties active. And how they did it in this game was that they used a four-corner version of the dime. What that entails is you effectively play two corners on either side, and whichever side, and you move one if necessary, but whichever side has only one receiver or one flexed player, the other side then ends up being the effective second inside linebacker. And so they have a usually a responsibility to watch the running back more often than not, or watch a tight end who might be pass blocking and drifting out at some point to try and get into the pattern. So anyway, the four-corner dime is something that the Ravens have used in the past primarily to defend teams that run 10 personnel. So the Arizona Cardinals in the 2019 game, they had 19 of their 21 four-corner dime snaps of the entire season in that game because Arizona was about the only team in the NFL who really played any 10 personnel, and they played it a fair amount of the time. They didn't really have a tight end they trusted, so they had one running back and four wide receivers they were tossing out there, and the Ravens did a fairly effective job managing that. They gave up some plays in that game, but they did a fairly effective job having a four-corner dime out this. This game, the four-corner dime did not work at all. They allowed over 10 yards per play with the dime in there. And the stark difference from the nickel that I'll get to in just a minute when I talk packages and results. I'd say if you look at the box score in the game and you look down the offensive chart, which will give you, the number of plays and the rushing yards per attempt and whatnot, the Ravens seem to have a pretty good day stopping the run, that they held the Bills to 3.5 yards per carry. There are definitely some mitigating factors in that. The first is that the Bills knelt the ball three times for minus 5 yards at the end, which if you take those out of there immediately, they're up to 4.0 yards per carry. And then they also had a number of plays where they just tried to batter it in short yardage from inside the 5-yard line. And if that's a high percentage of your run plays and you're still scoring touchdowns on each of those opportunities, basically, which they did when they got it inside the five, then you're not really accomplishing your goals as a rush defense to hold them to 4 yards a carry. So anyway, they didn't have a whole bunch of long runs. They did a pretty good job against Allen, who was 11 for 35 in his non-kneels. That's 3.2 yards per carry. He had a long run of 9 yards. It's not like Allen escaped the pocket for a bunch of big runs against the Ravens. Like, if you know, obviously I was there at the game. You would not believe how upset the Bills fans were when Lamar ran for 19 yards, escaping pressure, his big play of the game. Lamar had a bunch of great plays in this game, but the 19-yard run where they let him get free, they're beyond themselves. They're like, you had him. And, you know, they let him get away for a big first down on, I think, a third and 10 or a third and 9. So impressive run there. And it was very demoralizing for the fans. A lot of the Bills fans left after that play. A lot more left after Henry scored to put the Ravens, I think it was Henry, scored to put the Ravens back up 15. But when they went back up 15, they thought, well, that's probably it. And another similarity to that 2003 Seattle game is that the Buffalo Stadium was half empty at the end. They were cheering loudly, and so were we in Baltimore in 2003 for the Ravens to come back against the Seahawks. But the stadium was half empty by that point. So, interesting. I hope the Bills fans, you know, beat the traffic going home anyway. It's just a nasty thing to say. All right, but it is. It's how I feel about it, honestly. All right, let's talk packages for a little bit, and then I'll break this, and we'll have a little bit shorter show than normal tonight. The first is the jumbo package. They had 2 yards on the one jumbo play, but it's a touchdown. Like I said, it doesn't really help to hold your opponent to 2 yards per play if you're giving up TDs. Really weird jumbo package. They had time to get a jumbo on the field. I believe it was after Humphrey. Yes, it was after Humphrey got hurt and he kind of lay down in the end zone. The Ravens put on a package that they've never played before and is probably worth mentioning here. A 5-1. Okay, let me get this correct here. I'll describe it. 5 linemen, 1 outside linebacker, 4 inside linebackers, and Kyle Hamilton. That's all they had on the field. They had all 4 of their inside linebackers, including Jake Hummel, on the field for his only snap on this goal line play. And they only had 1 outside linebacker, although they certainly could have used another. They had every defensive lineman they had active for the night was on the field at once. By the way, another good reason, don't ever activate only 4 offensive linemen or defensive linemen for a game. But anyway, they had that one play, and they were not able to stop a 2-yard run for a touchdown anyway. All right, getting back to some other packages the Ravens ran. They ran base 11 times, and the Bills racked up 62 yards against that, 5.6 yards per play. It's not terrible or anything, but it's obviously not exactly what you want. Some of that was passing. Some of it was running. The jumbo nickel, they played 1 time. That's a package they played a fair amount in the past, but it's been a while since they played it with any degree of frequency, and once is certainly not a whole lot. But the jumbo nickel specifically has 3 down linemen, 2 outside linebackers, 1 inside linebacker, and a 5-man secondary ordered in the normal way with a nickel back and 2 safeties. It's a play that the Ravens used in the past when they had really good run fit safeties. And it's an indication of some trust in both Hamilton and Starks that they can run fit as needed. Maybe well-deserved. I know in the past I've seen it deployed, and one of the things I would always look for, particularly when Mosley was still with the team, and they would run this is about 2018 or something, is he would always look backwards and make sure that the safeties understood the run fit was theirs to take on this play. But it was another way in which the Ravens did not commit to having that weak side linebacker spot be all that important. So effectively what you do with that package is you sacrifice one of your 2 inside linebackers. And guess what? It's the non-green dot guy, the Will linebacker, either Buchanan or Simpson, they took off the field and they put on a 3rd down lineman. It'd be something, if you had the option to do it against a team like Buffalo, you'd probably do it against sets where they add a 6th offensive lineman. And I did not check to see exactly what the Buffalo personnel was on the play where they deployed it. All right. They did not play any big nickel, so that would have been having Hamilton probably come down opposite the tight end. They were kind of light in the secondary. They deactivated Lowry in this game. As some people know, they also deactivated Keaton Mitchell, which drove me up the wall. But they deactivated Lowry, which meant they were kind of a safety short from doing some of the things they'd like to do with bringing Hamilton up close to the line of scrimmage. They did get Kane in the game for three plays in total. He came in once in a quarter package. He came in two other times in packages where Hamilton had run off to get his hand fixed. So he missed two snaps for that remedy. And during that time, Kane was in the game play. So he got a little bit of play in this game. They had one snap of rush nickel, ended up being a 17-yard pass. So that didn't work out either, where they kicked in an outside linebacker and had three of them on the field. In that case of rush nickel, it was a little bit unusual because they had still two linemen on the field. So they had kind of like five heavies up front with three of them being outside linebackers, that's the unusual way to play it. The more common way is it's like Matabike stays in the game and you have three outside linebackers and give yourself the fastest possible group of pass rushers to try and get downhill on the quarterback. So that's not exactly what they ran in this game and end up being a 17-yard play. Anyway, they played standard nickel. That was the one place where they were truly successful. 34 snaps, so it was not insignificant percentage of the total. 145 yards, 4.3 yards per play. Now, the big difference there is that Alexander was not on the field. Simply put, Alexander was not on the field, and he really hurt the Ravens in this game. Awuzie played quite well. Some of the other guys in the secondary had problems. They came at various times for various reasons. A lot of it, again, was because Allen was just been given a little bit too much time to escape the pocket, reset a secondary pocket, make a throw, and was very successful doing that. But the standard nickel in general was successful. Now we get to the four-corner dime. They played 25 snaps of that, 254 yards. That's 10.2 yards per play on that. Doesn't even get to the whole thing because Alexander also had a 27-yard, I think, defensive pass interference, which converted fourth and five. So just a whole lot of things went wrong. Hopefully, this is not the real Jaire Alexander we're showing, because it's certainly not what the contract says he is, and it's not what the Ravens hoped he would be. This is just a very tough game for him, and hopefully he'll be back and playing better ball. The quarter, they had one snap of that. It was the last play at the end of the first half, where they had no defensive alignment on the field. I think I mentioned this earlier, but two outside linebackers, two inside linebackers, and seven defensive backs. And they give up a 22-yard play. Didn't rush the passer. Gave Allen time to survey the field. Didn't have a lot of time because there's only 7 seconds on the clock, but eventually got the ball to the outside where Kincaid could make a play on it and get out of bounds before Humphrey could stop him. So unfortunate that they were able to convert that play. It cost the Ravens 3 points. And I think you could probably say that it had an impact on the game, although the Bills probably wouldn't have tried all their failed 2-point conversions if the score had been different. So they failed 3 2-point conversions during this game. So it could be they could have gotten the 3 points back in that way, or maybe 2 of the 3 points and still had a tie game from it. All right, we'll call it there for the first segment. I want to come back and I want to talk about the pass rush and some of the specifics about that. I've got a lot of detail on the pass rush that I'll talk about. And then I'll talk about the individual players. And I think there's a lot of things that happened in this game which tell you something about what the Ravens now believe about these individual players. Some interesting stuff. And again, we're getting the first kind of unveiling of what Orr's defense looks like this year. We don't like it at first, but there are things to be learned, I think, from talking about it. Anyway, that's going to do it for this episode. Appreciate all you folks. You're very loyal listeners. I tried to get through this episode with no profanity. I think I made it in this case, and this is not an easy game to do it, but hope you folks will hang with us. And if you want to do something nice for the show, tell somebody new about it, or write us a 5-star 50-word review out on your favorite podcast platform. We're now into the regular weekly rotation of shows really quickly. That involves two defensive shows, two offensive shows. Most of the time, those four shows will be done with a guest. Tonight, there happened to be a logistical problem that didn't work out. Then we do Know Your Foe, next. After that, we have Friday morning GM. We have a pair of matchup shows, one for the offense, one for the defense. And we have one last thing, which will fit in depending on the week where we can, but probably at the end of the week, perhaps on game day. Some very interesting topics that my co-hosts have come up with for that show. So I appreciate them very much. It's Brad McGowan and Sean Asher. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.